This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking again today with Marianne Garneau of the IWW and the publisher of Organizing Work, a publication that offers a chance for workers to look at what works and what doesn't when it comes to organizing our workplaces and changing our society from that point. We were talking about an article that she wrote for Organizing Work last year about big strikes and the sabotage of labor. And when we left off, we were talking about speed up. How does scientific management still show itself as an issue for workers? Because, you know, we're talking about, you know, industrial capitalism 100 years ago. We hear it all the time how unions were okay for a certain historical time because that's what we needed, but we don't need it anymore. In what ways are we still kind of living 100 years ago?
Well, I think if you look at the charts or graphs of the increase in productivity continues to grow and wages do not. So the bottom line is that workers are producing more outputs, they're doing more, they're generating more without really getting paid more. And wherever you work, especially right now, this is happening with coronavirus pandemic, every time they lay someone off and don't replace them, that's basically a speed up. Every time that you get handed another person, another half of a person's job function, or every time you work a little short staffed, or every time you're expected to do basically the same or more with less, that's the speed up. And that's been going on for decades. It's been going on probably since the beginning of capitalism, but if you look at the numbers, it's really been stark in the last several decades. There are a couple of specialized names that have been given to this in the roughly, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s. One is lean production and one is just-in-time supply chain. And we're seeing those during the coronavirus pandemic too, because used to have, let's say, 25 ICU beds in a hospital, and now they have like 6. And the philosophy is, well, why would we pay for 25 beds when most of the time, 20 of them are going to sit idle? It's not worth the cost. It's not worth the maintenance. So let's just have 6, which is the average amount that we need. And then, of course, what happens is you get a pandemic and suddenly you need 25, if not 50, and you don't have them. That's a philosophy that's been applied to basically everything in capitalism, whether it has to turn a profit or not. If you work in education, you've experienced this. If you work in healthcare, you've experienced this. And certainly if you work in a factory, you've experienced this. Well, let's work with as few workers as possible, working as hard as possible. And everything arrives just in time. Everything is made to be as efficient as possible. And then when you have, again, a pandemic, there are no masks, there are no testing kits, there's no vaccinations because we've shut down most production to make it as lean as possible.
You start to anticipate what I wanted to ask next about how in your article, a lot of the examples of shop floor power that you describe focus on these kind of traditional industrial settings of factories, mines, ports. Do we need to think differently about shop floor power in these kind of workplace contexts where the employer is the main and first consumer of workers' labor versus settings that are now kind of the norm for workers in this economy where you're working with the public, you're serving people, and setting aside how consumers and customers are awful, a lot of people like to serve the public in the ways they do. And it creates this barrier to thinking about your power on the job as something that belongs to you rather than to the people you serve.
There's a lot wrapped up in that. One thing I want to describe is how the significance of the way the IWW was organizing in its heyday. So it started in 1905 and, you know, continued through the early 1920s before a fairly precipitous decline, but it's still around today. Like I said, I'm a member and I'm not trying to boost it out of organizational chauvinism, but because any historian will say, and any labor person will say, there was something rather unique about the IWW's approach to how it organized. One of the things that was unique about its approach and still is that it wanted to organize unskilled workers. So prior to that, to an extent, the labor movement had functioned by taking skilled craft labor, and kind of putting a bit of a fence around it and bargaining with implicit leverage by virtue of owning that skilled labor and employers needing it, right? So if all of the master craftsmen in some particular field can say, we're in an organization now, and this is the rate at which we want to be paid, because it's not easy to find that kind of skilled craftsman and or to replace it or to duplicate that, you have to bargain with them. Whereas unskilled labor, and we've probably all experienced this, if you don't like it, there's the door, right, is what the boss's attitude is. You're replaceable. There are far more of you and more of you to go around, and you don't have the bargaining leverage as a result of being irreplaceable or having possession of some particular skill. even though it is a bit of a the notion of unskilled labor is a bit of a misnomer anyway, because, okay, go ahead, try to make a cappuccino in 30 seconds and try to make 50 of them in a row and make the latte foam pretty and whatever. You can't, right? Only a barista can do that. The IWW's approach was to organize this so-called unskilled labor, and that meant that your leverage had to be of a different kind. And it meant that you had to really gather absolutely everybody working in an industry, working in a mine, working in forestry, working in a mill, and make them willing to withdraw their labor. And again, the point of the article is that didn't just look like a big walkout strike every couple of years. Sometimes it looked like shutting down the machines for the day. Sometimes it looked like folding your arms and refusing to do a certain thing at a certain time. Lots of little strikes. But the approach was basically to organize unskilled labor to be able to withdraw its labor when it wanted to. The reason why I still think that's relevant today is because a lot of us do work in, let's say the service industry or jobs that are considered unskilled. And, most people in capitalism, and this has basically always been true, are in a position where their leverage is not being the rare possessor of a particular skill or craft, but being, a worker who works alongside other workers. And if they can develop the ability to act collectively, they can withdraw their labor as leverage.
And I think the principle, it sounds like, is the same, whether it's the craft or the industrial context. It's that it's easier to replace the labor of so-called unskilled workers, and that when you do it collectively, what becomes harder is replacing the number of unskilled workers that would represent. This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Marianne Garneau, organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World and publisher of Organizing Work, talking today about her article Big Strikes and the Sabotage of Labor, about the politics of shop floor power in the labor movement. Also on today's show, we have an interview with author Peter Cole about a biographical book he wrote about Ben Fletcher, who was organizing in the Philadelphia docks in the 19-teens and 20s with the IWW in its infamous Local 8. Marianne, you talked to Peter Cole last year on the Wobcast, the podcast for Organizing Work, and I want to ask you to relate a point you brought up then to our conversations today, how organizing for power on the job over the work process itself, workers in the IWW Local 8 in the time of Ben Fletcher's leadership abolished segregation on the docks, in the workplace, in dock life, and that this is the real political import of labor's power, is to directly transform the world.
Yeah, so it was interesting because, first of all, I think that Local 8, so the IWW local that the dock workers organized in Philadelphia with the help of Ben Fletcher, was very interesting because it was a great example of workers really controlling the job and taking action directly on the job in order to get what they want. So they secured significant increases in wages and overtime rates, and most importantly, they replaced the shape-up system where bosses could basically handpick who worked on the docks with a hiring hall, which meant that employers had to come to the union in order to get labor to work for them on the docks. And they desegregated work on the docks, which is a really remarkable feat for 1912 and for this period, especially considering that Philadelphia, like everywhere else in the United States, was deeply segregated, was very much a white supremacist society overall. And the fact that workers were able to do this through their own application of their labor power, basically, is a great illustration of the way that of what workers and labor can accomplish. And also, how powerful they are, including actually, especially when working outside of the formal contract and bargaining system.
Thanks for making that connection. I want to go back to what we were talking about a bit earlier, about what these shop floor struggles look like or could look like in a contemporary context, and ask you to speak on the concern that workers universally have when it comes to going on strike, but especially workers who are somehow serving the public directly, whether that's in the public sector or in the service sector.
So yeah, there's a bit of a concern where if what I do on a day-to-day level is teach children or deliver healthcare or facilitate the public's self-education by working in a library, then if I withhold my labor, the sufferer is going to be the community, the sick, the children, the poor, etc. The reality is that nurses, for example, have always struck. And when they strike, what they do is they prepare plans so that management nurses are the ones that have to do the work. Teachers, likewise, have struck. Sometimes school thereby gets shut down. But when teachers are striking, they are striking for things that not only improve their own working conditions, but that also served the public interest. Like, let's have smaller class sizes. Let's have better funding for schools and for non-academic extracurricular activities. Let's have better social welfare supports for students in the schools. So it's a misnomer to say that those workers can't strike or withdraw their labor. And it's also a misnomer to say that when they do so, they are simply hurting the public, as opposed to looking after the public's long-term interests. And I think that one of the things we've seen in the pandemic, again, is that one of the few institutions in society that has not only been looking after the public's interests, but has had the muscle to enforce the best practices for public health have been unions. Unions have been the one to shut down schools from in-person learning when infection rates were simply far too high. In some cases, they were simply holding local government jurisdictions to their word that they wouldn't open schools if the infection rate, transmission rate, was above a certain percentage point. And the public authorities were going back on their word, and teachers' unions were holding them to that. In a lot of cases, in the case of healthcare workers, they're the ones who have insisted on having adequate PPE and adequate staffing levels, not so that they feel better, but so that COVID doesn't blow through a hospital or a long-term care facility like wildfire, and it doesn't just spread from one place to another place to another place. Speaking of which, there are all kinds of ways you can see capitalism has organized work that has contributed to the spread of COVID, where, for example, if most of the people who are working in long-term care facilities make very little money and therefore have to work in more than one place at a time, and they became vectors for the spread of the disease. And so when they demand higher wages and benefits and better scheduling and full-time hours, that's not just a selfish concern on their part. That's something that is holding the public health at stake. So striking is something that's completely available, and labor disruption is and should be available to public sector workers, and that is in the community interest. And I've been writing about this lately. There's a whole debate on bargaining for the common good. But as far as how much public support you need to carry out a strike, it certainly helps. It certainly makes those workers feel better. But I think what we've seen is that the real leverage that gets the job done and that carries the day is those workers withholding their labor or threatening to withhold their labor. That an ounce of that is worth a pound of public support in terms of actually getting those demands met.
What I've noticed is that in the framing of like bargaining for the common good, there's a recognition that there is a need to incorporate the public that gets served into the mutual aid process. Because when you go out on strike and you're not getting pay, that means that you need some kind of alternative support network. And with public sector workers, there's people who need some kind of support that the public sector workers on strike, you know, are withholding. And in the case of like the Red for Ed teachers, there was extensive and months-long preparation in terms of making sure that those support networks existed. But with a shop floor struggle attitude about it being, you know, something that we decide when it comes up on the shop floor, if that means up to and walking out for the day, but you don't have those preparations in line, I wonder whether you just run into the issue that would affect a big strike of simply calling a strike without having preparations.
Yes. So let me explain, I think, for the sake of the audience, that when I describe the day-to-day shop floor struggle, describe sabotage, but also when workplaces started to be formally organized, more formally organized and unions actually recognized in the workplace through these official legal processes, what that looked like did not look how it looks today, where it's sort of this very orderly process, the grievance process that ends in arbitration, as I said, and the, you know, formal bargaining process. What it looked like, and I'll read an excerpt from, again, one of the historical pieces I quoted. What it looked like was this. At Studebaker, it became, so, you know, auto factory, It became standard practice for shop stewards to meet every morning to plan their approach to the day's work. So shop stewards, workers, planning their approach to the day's work. Exercising effective control over the company's piece rate pay system, they thought of the foremen, the bosses, as just clerks. In the farm equipment industry, stewards held a veto over the work norms set by supervision. And at Armour's main Chicago plant, packing house union stewards developed a tactic they called whistle bargaining. Each steward wore a whistle around his or her neck. Whenever a supervisor declined to discuss a grievance, the steward gave a blast on the whistle and the department halted work. When the issue was resolved, the steward whistled twice and production started again. So that kind of immediate stop and go, screw it, we're downing tools until this particular grievance is fixed. And a lot of those grievances had to do with the pace of work, right? That's what the labor movement used to look like, which is absolutely unheard of today.
I've been talking with Marianne Garneau, organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World and publisher of Organizing Work, that is found at organizing.org, about her article, Big Strikes and the Sabotage of Labor. Tune in next week to hear us round out our conversation about the politics of shop floor power and workers' direct capacity to change their workplace and the world. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement.